Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. On this podcast, we feature a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The presentation is entitled MOOCs, The Coming Revolution. Our speakers include Daphne Koller, co-CEO of Coursera Incorporated, and Brian Voss, Vice President and CIO at the University of Maryland.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for being here at the very tail end of this conference. So thank you for sticking with us this long. The title of this talk is The Online Revolution, Education for Everyone, and I'm going to start with the online revolution piece of it and end with the implications of education for everyone. So this whole year of the MOOC, as it's come to be called, I think really started out almost exactly a year ago today, in October of 2011, when Stanford put forward three courses open to everyone around the world. And we saw students from 196 countries registering in literally the hundreds of thousands. And so to understand the implications of that, let me talk about one of those classes, the machine learning class taught by my colleague Andrew Ng. Andrew teaches a machine learning class to 400 people at Stanford every time it's taught. It's considered a large class even at Stanford. When Andrew opened up his machine learning class to everyone around the world, he had 100,000 students registered for that class. So to understand what that number means, it means that to reach that number of students, Andrew would have to teach his Stanford class for 250 years. And so that really drove home to us the sort of impact that one could have by providing a truly high-quality education in an online form to everyone around the world for free, which you could do when you have effectively a zero marginal cost per student. Now, the other part of this is that for those of us who have taught such classes, including myself, the real impact to us is not just the numbers. The thing that really touches the most is the number of students, usually a few hundred, whose lives are completely transformed by having access to this kind of education. So this is one of our favorite stories. It's one of the earlier ones. Ryan couldn't go to school because his daughter had an autoimmune disease, and he couldn't risk infecting her with germs by going outside the house and coming back in. A few months later, Ryan wrote us an email saying that baby Shannon is doing much better. You can see her on the left. And that he actually got a job as a database intern by having taken some of these classes. Now, this is a domestic story. There are such stories all over the world. I got a story from one of my own classes from a student who lives in a war zone in the Afghan-Pakistani border who had to drop out of school after a year to support his family. And he sent me an email asking whether I could give him a scholarship to take my class. And I explained that I didn't need to give him one because it was free. And he sent back an email with a tone of disbelief saying, "Are you sure? And in that case, can I please take two?" And so that was really, I think, it's those kinds of experiences that make this truly worthwhile. Now, what is it that makes these so impactful? After all, online course materials have been around for a while. There's a lot of this, including some of very high quality. The difference is that these are courses that really try and replicate in this online form as closely as possible in this education at scale what an on-campus course experience would look like. So the course begins on a given day, and every week there's content that the students have to get through. And every week there's homework. And the homework is graded, so students get feedback, immediate feedback on how well they're doing. And if they don't do their homework, they don't get a grade. And you can see the implications of that in the usage graph that you see here, where the x-axis is the timeline and the y is the number of users on the site. You see these bumps? Those are deadlines. And you can see that basically procrastination seems to be a completely universal phenomenon. Now, at the end of the course, the students get something that is a tangible benefit to the work that they put in. They get a certificate. It's not credit-bearing, but it's useful. And we've been told by many of our students that these certificates have gotten them jobs, and not just in the computer science and information technology industry. We've heard that from other disciplines as well. And so these are useful things that really make all this hard work worthwhile. So let's talk a little bit about what the components of this course look like. So first of all, there is the use of video as a medium of instruction. And we have had an amazing range of different creative uses of the video medium that instructors come up with once they are allowed to move away from the constraints of in-class instruction. So on the top left is the University of Illinois Sustainability course, where they shot a lot of things on site to demonstrate issues relating to sustainability. The top right is the University of Pennsylvania Affordable Care Act course that was timed to coincide with the Supreme Court decision on the Obamacare Act. And this is an interview with Zeke Emanuel, who's the instructor of the course and one of the authors of that bill, talking about the implications of the Supreme Court decision. Bottom left, you see our favorite Dr. Chuck. Dr. Chuck, are you here with us in the audience? Who did some really amazing stuff with preparing content in a way that he was deeply engaged with the content even as it was on the slide. And then on the bottom right, the UPenn gamification course, where the instructor taught an entire class as a computer game character to illustrate the benefits of gamification. So a lot of creative stuff. Now, of course, it's not just about video, passively watching videos. As educators, we all know that interacting and engaging with the material is of critical importance. This is a paper from Science 2011 that demonstrates that even simple retrieval practice is a really important part of the learning experience, and students who engage with that perform much better on a downstream test than ones who just passively review material. And so we've built an interaction in many different places in trying to get a better student experience. So the first is, even the videos themselves are not passive things. So as the student watches the video occasionally pauses, and students get asked a question. So here's an example of that. There's sound in here, but I'm not playing that. This is the University of Michigan Model Thinking course with Scott Page. And you can see that when the video hits the yellow notch, a question pops up, and the student gets to answer a question. They get immediate feedback as to whether they're tracking or not, or whether they kind of stopped paying attention and went on Facebook, for example. And then at the end of this, they basically are given potentially an optional explanation. Now, this is the kind of question that you might ask in class as an instructor, but when you ask such questions in class, 80% of the students are still scribbling the last thing you said. The back row are all on Facebook. And then there's the smarty pants in the front row who blurts out the answer before anyone else really has a chance to think about it. And as an instructor, you're really gratified that somebody at least knew the answer to your question. And so you say, great job, and the class moves on before most people have even noticed that a question had been asked. Here, every student has to engage with the material. Now, of course, these little baby questions are not where the real action is. The real action is in the much deeper, more meaningful assessments that students do and the weekly homeworks. And of course, the big question is, how do you grade the homework of 100,000 students when your administration is not willing to fund 5,000 teaching assistants? And so what happens is that you begin to develop methods for grading at scale. And so there's a bunch of things beyond multiple choice that you can grade at scale, including short answer questions, programming assignments, including some pretty sophisticated programming assignments. Things that are not normally viewed as programming assignments, but really in some sense are, like Excel spreadsheets, for example, marketing models, financial models, as well as the ability to grade mathematical expressions in a fairly deep way that is not just syntactic equivalence. Now, that's all very well, but when we went and started talking to some of our university partners in the early days about the benefits of this, they said, we want this to be open not just to our faculty working in the quantitative disciplines. We want our humanities and social sciences faculty also to be able to participate. So we tried to explain that, you know, multiple choice was underrated. That didn't go over very well. And so we had to come up with a very different strategy. And the strategy we came up with is peer grading, where students do very creative, open-ended assignments, including some of these, like from the University of Illinois Sustainability class, where students have to design a web page or a wiki or all sorts of or policy plan. And then other students, using a grading rubric provided by the instructor, grade the work of their fellow students. And each piece of work is graded by 5 students after a calibrated peer review process so that you get a certain robustness in the results of this. Now, this technique of calibrated peer review had been demonstrated as being effective in small classes of 20 to 30 students, but no one had tried this at the kinds of scales that we were talking about. And so we had to build on that technology as well as ideas from the realm of crowdsourcing to try and put together a package that gave reasonably robust answers. So let me show you some very preliminary results. These are hot off the press. These are from our very first class to launch with peer grading, the Stanford Human-Computer Interaction class. These were students grading web designs. And what you see here is the distribution of the difference between peer grades and instructor grades. And you can see that there is a sharp peak around zero, which is where you'd like it to be, but there is also a pretty, you know, big tail around the sides. And by and large, about 60% of the students are within a fairly small tolerance of the instructor grades. Assuming assumes that instructor grades is actually ground truth, which is arguable, but about 60% are within that. So that's sort of encouraging, but not wonderful. Far more, I think, encouraging is this next slide, which shows the performance of what was an aggregate on the previous slide broken down into the 4 assignments, assignments 2, 3, 4, and 5 that you can see over here. And what you see again in this case, the zero is the vertical line, and you can see that in the first 2 assignments, there is a huge spread around zero, but as you get to assignments 4 and 5, that spread becomes considerably narrower. And I think we don't exactly know what the reasons for this are. It could be that the students learned how to do peer grading, but I think equally we learned how to construct better grading rubrics. It turns out that constructing grading rubrics is really tricky and is an art form, and we're all kind of learning together how to do this effectively. Okay, now let's talk about some of the benefits of this kind of system in terms of some of its implications. So the first is that it provides us with a new window into human learning because we measure every single event in the system. Every click, every pause of a video, rewind, submission of an assignment. And so you can start gathering information in a way that you really didn't have the data to do before. So let me give just one example of that, and I can talk about other examples if people are interested in the question session. Here is a distribution of wrong answers in one of Andrew's machine learning assignments. The answers happen to be pairs of numbers, so you can draw them on a grid. Every little cross is a one-off wrong answer, where a student came up with some new way to get something wrong. The big crosses are ones where a lot of students in this infinite space got the exact same wrong answer. So when 2 students in a class of 100 get the same wrong answer, you'd never notice, but when 2,000 students get the same wrong answer, it kind of jumps out at you. And so Andrew and his TAs went, looked into some of the assignments, understood the root of the misconception, and now every student whose answer falls into that bucket in the top left gets not just a "you're wrong" error message, but actually a targeted error message that explains to them that they might want to go and think about the problem in this way, giving them much more personalized feedback that helps them achieve learning outcomes more effectively. Which brings me to the next point about some of the potential opportunity that we see here. Which is a potential solution to a 30-year-old problem. Back in 1984, renowned educational researcher Benjamin Bloom wrote a paper called The Two Sigma Problem. In that paper, Bloom studied 3 populations. The first is the achievement scores of 3 populations. The first one, which you see here in blue, are students taught in a traditional lecture-based format. Not a huge lecture, it's 30 students in a lecture. The second is students taught in a lecture-based format, but in a mastery learning form, which means they couldn't move to the next topic before having demonstrated mastering the previous one. And the final are those students fortunate enough to have an individual human tutor. Now you can see that the red curve is a full standard deviation, or sigma, to the right of the blue curve, and the green curve is yet another sigma to the right of that. Now, to understand the implications of 2 standard deviations difference in these distributions, if you take the distribution of students, if you take the median of the lecture-based population as a performance threshold, so that half are above and half are below that threshold, and use that same threshold for performance on the green population, you get that 98% of your students are above that same level of performance, which is a huge improvement in learning outcomes. Hence the 2 sigma problem. Because as Bloom pointed out, even in the title of his paper, we are not, as a society, cannot afford to provide a human tutor to every student. But maybe we can provide every student with a tablet or at least a smartphone. And if we can do that, the question is, can we now use technology to move us from the blue curve to the red curve and ultimately to the green curve? Now, the red curve is easy because the nice thing about computers is that they're happy with mastery. They don't mind showing you the same video 5 times. They don't even mind grading the same assignment five times, unlike my TAs. Personalization is a little harder to achieve, but I think some of the abilities to go through the curriculum at your own pace and some of the personalized feedback that one can give might move us closer to the green curve, and I think there is a big opportunity there. Okay, the third large piece of the student experience in these courses, beyond video and assessments, is the community. And students actually form, because of the cohort effect, because they are all going through the course at the same time, a really vibrant community of learners that help each other along through the hard bits, allowing us to scale one of the few things that you really can scale in these big online courses, which is the instructor time in terms of answering questions. So on the discussion forum, students would ask questions, and other students would answer those questions. And this is one of those counterintuitive places where having a large class is actually helpful, because if you ask a question, even at 3 o'clock in the morning, somewhere around the world, somebody knows the answer to that question and is logged onto the site. So the median response time for questions on this discussion forum is about 20 minutes. Which is certainly not a level of service that I've ever been able to provide to my Stanford students. Now, in addition to this type of interaction, students also interacted around the content in other ways. So one of our instructors, who taught a poetry class at Penn, had students post their essays following peer grading, so the essays with the comments on the discussion forum, and you had students commenting on each other's comments and on each other's essays. And there were sometimes, so you see, here's a discussion that had 60 posts on a single student's essay and 872 students who viewed that essay and the discussion around it. So really a vibrant discussion around a course that I have to say is considered inaccessible even at Penn and has 33,000 students in the public domain, a poetry class. In addition to that type of community, students organically formed into study groups. And here you have students who are in all sorts of locations around the world getting together once a week to study the material. And currently we have over 1,500 communities in over 1,300 cities around the world, ranging from the icy wilderness of Siberia all the way down to Tierra del Fuego in South America and everywhere else. Now, some of these communities are, in fact, physical, but many are virtual. So you see, for example, Russian-speaking students, as well as one of our favorites are those students, or as you see at the bottom left, the multilingual universal study groups are those students who deliberately wanted to connect with students from other cultures. So let me wrap this up with this part of the talk with a bit of a status update. Currently working with us, we have 33 universities offering over 200 courses. I'll talk about that in just a second. We have close to 1.85 million students enrolled on the platform taking courses across the range of disciplines. These are students from every country around the world, unfortunately except for North Korea, I think, that blocks this. And let me just show some cute visuals. So this is our partner institutions. We're very, very fortunate to have such a tremendous set of institutions that are happy to provide their content to people around the world. We have courses from the range of disciplines, including humanities, social sciences, business, philosophy, computer science, math, astronomy, biology, and pretty much anything else. Music, we have an actual performance music class. Graded using peer grading. This is the growth curve of the students, and you can see this effort really started in the middle of April. By August 9th, we had 1 million users. It's growing at a pretty steady state of 70,000 students per week, new students every week. Okay, so now I'm going to turn attention for just a couple minutes to the kinds of implications that this has on on-campus teaching, because we focused all of the discussion so far on the technology and on all those students around the world, but what does it imply for our own on-campus teaching? So the first question is, does it make us all obsolete? Are universities about to go out of business? So one quote that tends to support that view, a quote typically attributed to Mark Twain but incorrectly, is that college is a place where professors' lecture notes go straight to the students' lecture notes without passing through the brains of either. Now, I actually don't subscribe to this as the right model for college, and the quote that I like to give is this one, which goes even further back to Plutarch, that says that the mind is not a vessel that needs filling, but wood that needs igniting. And we spend so much of our time on college campuses basically filling our students' minds with content in a lecture, and maybe we should do something different. And so the thing that you could do different is have the students get that mundane content out of the class in what I argue is a more engaging format than at least a large lecture course, maybe not more engaging than a small seminar, but for a course that has more than 50 or 60 people, this is actually more interactive. And then you can use the precious time where the instructor and the students are actually in the same room at the same time to do things like just-in-time teaching. Figure out what the students didn't understand from that week's content based on the quiz scores and the homework assignments and address those misconceptions as opposed to lecture everything. Or do real-world case studies that not only serve to motivate the students but also teach them what to do when you want to apply these academic ideas in practice, where you know what to do when the rubber hits the road. And do all sorts of team problem solving and active learning ideas that foster both collaboration skills, problem solving skills, and so on. And one of the things that we've seen is that we have flipped more classrooms using this effort than we have done in many years prior to this. So let me briefly mention some other unexpected benefits that that we're seeing from this. First of all, we're told by all of our partner institutions that all of a sudden teaching is interesting to people. People whose focus primarily had been on their research and teaching was the kind of thing that you did because you needed to get your salary paid are now really passionate about how do you take their ideas, their intellectual brainchild, and convey it to all these people around the world. And we've seen interest in pedagogy as well as interest on the research side in terms of the data analytics in improving teaching. We've seen the global classroom, where students are present from all over the world, provide a tremendous inspiration to instructors about ideas that would not have occurred to them based on the interactions that they have with a fairly homogeneous population that we have at most U.S. universities. Here you all of a sudden are exposed to ideas from Vietnam, from New Zealand, from South Africa, and you can really be inspired in understanding these different points of view. And finally, by having so many peer institutions all working together in developing what is effectively a new pedagogy, because one of the things that we've learned from this is that teaching online isn't and shouldn't be taking face-to-face instruction and just putting it on video. It needs to be something different. And we don't know what that different thing is because we're all learning, and it's a very brand new direction for many of us, and we can all learn faster by learning together. And we're seeing that transfer of information across both institutional and disciplinary boundaries in action. So how can one use this content? There's actually a number of different ways. I'm going to skip past this and do the questions. I'm just going to end because I want to give Brian some time. Okay. So I'm going to go back to the very beginning of the talk. And I'm going to talk about the education for everyone part of the title. And this is sort of the big vision slide, so please forgive me if it gets a little bit sort of over the top. What is to be gained by making education accessible to everyone? First, it turns education, high quality education, from a privilege of the few to something that's a basic human right. And that means that anyone around the world who wants to make their life better has the opportunity, if they have the skill and motivation, to learn something new that might get them a better job and a better life for their families. Second, it allows us lifelong learning. Maybe 150 years ago, the stuff that we learned in college was enough to last us through our life. The world now is moving far too quickly for the stuff that we learn in college to be still all we need to know to get through life. This gives us the opportunity, every time we want to learn something new, whether it's something concrete with pragmatic benefits like a computer science course or a business course, or whether it's something that we just want to expand our minds like the poetry class, it gives us an opportunity to have that whenever we want it. And then finally, there is that big sort of the big opportunity, the big gamble, which is that talent can be found everywhere. And maybe there is an Albert Einstein or a Steve Jobs that's living in Africa or in Bangladesh, and if you give them access to this kind of education, maybe they'll come up with a really great idea that can make the world a better place. Thank you. No, I'll put it up for you. Okay.
So I realize you didn't come to see me. So I'm going to try and do this quickly and let you ask questions of Daphne. But what I do want to do, I think I can provide some perspective for the IT folks in the room, what the process looked like from the other side, joining Coursera, what you had to go through. In fact, when Daphne and I talked today, you know, she was not aware of what it really was like on the other side. So I told her the story. And I'm also going to share some thoughts about what I think all this means. So let me just kind of move into this. Play a little identity management game. These two pictures, do you guys know who these two are? Anybody? How about the names help? Pierre DuPont and Johnny Starbuck. Anybody? Hand? Okay, great. I like knowing something that no one else knows. How about these two? All right. Keith Richards, Ronnie Wood. So Pierre and Johnny are the guitar techs for the Rolling Stones, and they have been the guitar techs for the Rolling Stones for almost the entire 50 years that the Stones have been playing. So what does that have to do with this? All right, other than the fact that I'm getting old because I actually had to help Daphne understand who those two were. And I mean Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood. It's not about IT, all right? It's not about us. IT people in the room, this is not about you. We are the techs backstage. This is about teaching and learning, right? This is about the stars who are on stage. Those four pictures you see there, those are four of the faculty who are teaching three of the courses that the University of Maryland is offering through Coursera. So I'm going to come back to this point later, so remember that. All right, so I want to take you through this, briefly, the story of how the University of Maryland became a participant in Coursera, how I got to meet Daphne and spend many hours long into Saturday and Sunday evenings on the phone with her, and also why it was good to be part of a community, and yet that also had some untoward things for me. So April, May is rolling around. I'm thinking about what am I going to do this summer. Typical, you know, first-year CIO sorts of things. Got to do some hiring, really work on a strategic plan, really believe in strategic planning. All those things that we all have to do and have to face, this is what I was thinking was going to occupy my summer. Oops. A lot of things started to happen, many of which I wasn't really paying much attention to. I had read about the Stanford classes, which gave rise to Coursera, and had read about the other things, and certainly the edX announcement, when it came about, sort of got attention. But it was really the University of Virginia episode that sort of woke me up and made me think, I think there may be something else going on. And my life changed on July 17th, when at 3 a.m. that morning, Daphne's organization put out a press release announcing that there had been an addition of 12 new partners into Coursera. And I looked down that list as I was reading the story that morning and saw, oh, I see Rice, Duke, and University of Virginia on there. I know those CIOs. I know Cameron Kahn and Tracy Futhi and James Hilton. I'm going to call them and say, what's this mean? I mean, what are you doing? What's going on with this? And so... I heard that the role of providing some IT support, helping with the filming, doing those sorts of things. And James told me, well, because of what was going on at Virginia, he actually had been put on point. And as I hung up the phone, I said, poor James. And then an hour later, my president called me. And an hour after that, I was in his office for an hour and a half, at which time it was poor Brian. I mean, what am I doing in the middle of this? What do I do next? Well, exactly 12 hours after the press release, I send a note to Daphne. Hi, how are you, Daphne? We in Maryland would kind of like to talk to you. All right, so choosing Coursera. Coursera was an entity that obviously was looking to expand its participants. It was a very interesting platform. It was a great story, had some great results already, and so we made contact with them. Our president, after that, during that period, started thinking about, this is what leading institutions do, all right? This is also the case that we were getting a lot of pressure from the community that we ought to do something. And so Wallace Lowe was really much behind this. From my perspective, my contribution to this thought process was to say, you know, I think we can learn more about how this is going to impact us if we actually do it, as opposed to sitting on the sidelines and watching and reading about others doing it. So that was sort of the attraction of this. And, oh, by the way, I wasn't going to have $60 million to throw at this to set up our own thing. So Daphne described this as a pretty easy process to get it done. And, in fact, many of my colleagues in the other institutions had done this in a matter of days. And we were going to have almost 3 months. So I figured this was as easy as 1, 2, 3, 4, although maybe it's a little bit more like binomial theorem. The contract part was certainly very easy. Daphne, you've all seen the contract that's been posted online, so you know there's no magic to it. But with all those little things that lawyers like to complain about, Daphne was very adept at saying, sure, we can deal with that. Creating course landing pages. If you've been to Coursera, you'll see every page or every course has this, which really acts almost like a trailer for a movie and a synopsis. It really is kind of advertising, getting people to show interest in it. And so, you know, that was a pretty straightforward, if non-trivial, process. We did have some people that wanted to take multiple takes because suddenly they're on TV. Partnering on the release. So, you know, Daphne and Coursera said, we want to make a splash with this, so shh, quiet. 3 months is a long time to keep a secret. And, in fact, we didn't actually do so well at that. Little story. And when you're in sort of the Beltway area and you put out a thing and says, hey, we're looking at online learning, and we're also talking to Coursera sort of down in the fine print, the Washington whatever picks that up and suddenly everybody knows about it. So probably the most interesting and difficult part of this was identifying those faculty. This is a challenge. It was summertime. You know, the faculty weren't around. All right? We're having to do this on the QT, right? We don't want people to really know that we're going to be with Coursera until it's announced. So how do we go out and recruit people? The big question is, who's going to decide what gets offered here? What classes get done? We had a lot of people who started showing up and volunteering to do this, but they had no clue as to what was going to be involved with it. And some of them, when they found that out, sort of repelled like Dracula from the cross. There was also confusion of mission. People thought, oh, so we've picked this. This is it. MOOCs, Coursera, that's it. Nothing else. That's our online strategy. And that was a challenge to dealing with that. Plus, this deal of, you know, you have to act swiftly versus our normal university processes, which tend to be deliberative, inclusive, and take a long time. So our process at Maryland was pretty straightforward. Our provost solicited the deans, who turned around and solicited department chairs, who talked to faculty. They submitted potential classes upward. The provost's office reviewed those, created sort of a, here's our primary crew and our backup crew, and we made our initial selections. And on October 19th, we were part of the next wave of Coursera announcements that came out with our four classes. A few modifications along the way. We're going to end up offering five that will start in January and through the spring. And we're just now, so if anyone's going to ask me what's involved in actually putting one of these courses together, don't ask, because I don't know. Because we're just now getting started with this. I can tell you what's involved in putting a course landing page together, though. So, you know, again, the broader challenges is, as I said, this is not about IT. But sometimes we in IT end up having to go on point. And the real question is how are we going to manipulate the process to get backstage where we belong? The other main thing is really getting folks to understand, again, it's not about IT because it's about pedagogy. It's about changing the way faculty teach. And they need to understand that and embrace it. All right? This is, again, this is not, IT may be the media which is causing this disruption, but the disruption is to some other system. And for all of us IT people, the thing from ERP days is this is business process reengineering, except the business process is teaching. So at Maryland, even as we're preparing these courses, the conversation continues. We have a commission of faculty and representatives from across campus that are talking about this. Are MOOCs an end? I mean, is this it? Or what else is? What else are we going to do? I've been using the analogy of a spice rack. All right, a MOOC is a spice in the rack. There are many other spices that we as a university are going to have in an online blended world. How are we going to make money off of this, and how are we going to certify? I heard a lot of questions about that to Ann earlier today. Don't ask that question either, because I don't know. This is all, we're going to figure this out. Another interesting question is this one of, are we going to have a centralized leadership role? You've seen many announcements from Stanford and other universities that are creating a vice provost or a vice president or whatever for online enterprises. This is an interesting question, and I think it's going to have to do with the environment at each institution. And again, what is going to be the role of IT? So I call these my thoughts, and not because I'm trying to claim ownership. I'm just trying to allow you to blame me for whatever comes out of my mouth next. And many of you know I'm a real fan of movies, right? So trying to psych up and what movies am I going to watch as I'm getting ready for the coming year. You know, this is a revolution. Let's just hope it's a bloodless coup. So everyone is always thinking that, well, we're going to get some great device that's going to fix this, right? And that's not going to happen. If you're familiar with that plague, Godot never comes. So, you know, this is not going to be about some technological piece of hardware. It's about humanware. It's about people. And we're going to have to make a pretty significant investment because we are changing over the way faculty are teaching. We're doing that business process reengineering. And how that's going to be done, whether it's going to be centralized or whether it's going to be facilitated through Centers for Teaching and Learning and Academic Affairs or IT learning technologies groups and CIOs or whatever, that is going to really depend upon the institutional culture. We are unique snowflakes. I believe that this effort has got to be led out of the academy. IT can partner and collaborate. Charlie McMahon told me from Tulane that when his president came back from the AAU meeting a week or so ago where this was a major topic, basically said, you and the provost are going to hold hands and walk into the night. Well, that's what's going to happen. That's, I think, the best way for this to work. But the provost has to be leading the way. The CIC CIOs wrote a paper not long ago, is this time different? And they say, yes, it is. And I say, you bet it is. You know, governing boards are putting a lot of pressure on administrations to do something and putting them in a pinch point with faculty. That's an interesting challenge. Our students are demanding this kind of technology enablement. This is the 21st century. They want to use that technology. Faculty are across the spectrum. As Daphne said, there are faculty who are energized and excited about this, and there are faculty who are scared to death of this and want nothing to do with it. There's that whole spectrum. And this challenge is also raising a lot of IT-centric issues. A lot of us have dealt a long time with this issue of centralization versus decentralization. And one of the arguments I'm using now is all that stuff that you've been doing, like doing your own email and giving out your own IDs and stuff, that's really not where it's at. Let us do that, and you guys go and help your faculty use technology to change the way they teach. Lastly, there's going to be this debate of, is this better? And I'm saying, boy, that's an academic discussion, not us. All right? So, and I think if we are called into this conversation, what Clay Shirky said yesterday, that example he gave about music, where he was talking about the CD versus the MP3, perfect way to phrase this. So if you got something from this conference, you got an answer to that question, courtesy of Clay. So life during wartime, another age probably related reference I just made. You know, I think that the CIC CIOs are right. This time is different. We don't have time for fooling around now. We need to be moving. So back to me personally, how'd that summer work out for me? Well, aside from getting Coursera up, I pretty much got through and did all the things that I thought I was going to do, except I didn't do them. The great staff of my organization did, made these things happen while I was focusing a lot of energy on this. And, I went to Paris, too. So just as a takeaway, the Chronicle of Higher Education, not mean to promote them too much, but they've done a great job of creating sort of a microsite where they're keeping track of all this stuff. And that's my new homepage. But EDUCAUSE is a great resource and an even getting better resource in this regard. If you haven't seen the primer, What Campus Leaders Need to Know About MOOCs, go out and get it and give it to your president, chancellor, provost, and others. There has been a constituent group on MOOCs for quite some time. So that discussion is already underway. And EDUCAUSE is planning a MOOC gathering of some sort for next summer as this process continues to develop, and we'll certainly have more information by then. So what questions do you have for Daphne? Working your ways to the microphones. You're first.
Great presentation. Thank you very much. Just two questions. This is pretty new to me. First question is, who owns the intellectual property? Is it the school? Is it the faculty? Is it Coursera or whoever might be the host? That's the first question.
Okay. So I can answer your question partially. It's not Coursera. It's somewhere in between the university and the instructor. Different institutions take very different positions on that, and I try very hard to stay away from that question.
Okay, great. Thank you. And the second one is, can the school withdraw their class from Coursera or whoever the might be holding the MOOC?
So part of our agreement is that when a course first goes up, there is a lifespan to it that's agreed upon as part of the initial agreement, and a course can't be withdrawn during that lifespan unless it becomes grossly erroneous in a way that can't be fixed. You can change it, but you can't withdraw it unless there is some really good reason.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, go over here.
Great presentation. Thanks for both the perspectives, Coursera as well as the university partner. I'm curious, from the perspective of someone who's not one of the partners, maybe one of the 5,000 other universities and colleges out there who have an interest in using this great content, but who doesn't necessarily want to be tied to the entirety of the content and the platform because they have their own IT infrastructures, et cetera. I mean, how do the rest of us play with you in a way that doesn't involve taking it lock, stock, and barrel?
So we've had a fair bit of interest, especially recently, in institutions wanting to use certain pieces of the content, and we're certainly not mandating that you use all of it or even the entirety of a single course. And we do a lightweight, not a full scale, but a lightweight integration with your campus IT system so that, for example, students can authenticate onto the Coursera platform using the credentials that they have from their university, which means that they can sign on and the grades can be reported back to your campus IT system so that you could use the content in a way that ties in to what your campus is already doing in terms of LMSs, for example.
So that's an integration into this sort of student information and so on, how does that integrate into someone else's LMS?
So we don't integrate into an LMS. It's a separate system. You can call out to that. You can have, the students call out to that. They can go, they can look at the content, they can do the assignments. The grades are reported back to the faculty member into a grade book on your LMS that can then be integrated in whatever other types of assessments you want to include in the context of your class.
Yes, this is an entirely new concept to me, too. And I'm wondering, since students self-select enrollment in these courses, and most of them don't have the benefit of advisors and things like that, how do you determine whether you have the prerequisite knowledge to take some of these courses?
So one of the, I think, beauties of this is that we actually don't. We let students self-select and we let them try it. And if they try and it turns out this is not what they should be doing, either because this is not something they're interested in or because the level is too easy or too hard for them, they can just drop out. And this is a risk-free way for students to explore new directions and new levels of difficulty, which is something that our college system is very bad at doing. If you sign up for a class, all of a sudden you're on the hook for $2,000 worth of tuition and a failing grade in your transcript if you drop out. And we really like the fact that students can try different things, and either it works or it doesn't.
Hi. If you were an institution that wanted to become a partner of Coursera, how would you initiate that process if you don't know any of the CIOs in this institution?
You come talk to me. That's the short answer.
Yeah, in fact, literally, if you send an email to Daphne, Daphne answers it. Not some machine, not somebody down the road. I don't know. There must be like four of her. Maybe there's a class on cloning. But she's the person who actually engages. So by all means, drop her a line. That's how I got started.
I will approach you then at the end of the conference. Thank you.
I had a resource question and an IP question. On the IP side, if institutions are producing the video segments and uploading them into the platform, presumably, from what I understood, they would still have control of their video segments to use locally as well.
That's
if
right.
It wasn't in the platform. Second, on the resource side, from the existing institutions, have you benchmarked the approximate amount of time or resources that it takes to put the videos together and the assessments within the Coursera platform?
So to the first part of your question, yes, repeating the answer from before, the university owns the IP not just to the videos but also to the assessments. Our agreement is not exclusive. If you want to put the same videos up on YouTube, that's fine with us as well. And so it's very clear. And it's one of the reasons why we don't produce your videos. You produce your videos so that the ownership of the IP is crystal clear. Now, in terms of the work that's required, there's a huge variation on that. And actually, the bulk of the variation is more on the construction of the assessments than on the construction of the videos. We find that once instructors get over the hump of teaching to a camera, which is often a bit intimidating, and some people strive for excessive perfectionism, which means they spend 10 takes doing something that they could really should do in one. Once they get beyond that hump, the recording time is about twice the time of the final produced video for the limited amount of retakes and also for just pausing to think about what you want to say next. So you're effectively doing your prep at the same time that you're doing your teaching. So the video recording time is really not that bad. What's a much bigger workload is constructing assessments that can be graded at scale. And this is, in many ways, a really useful pedagogical exercise for a faculty member because it forces you to think about assignments in a brand new way. In terms of, I mean, many of us should but don't think about assignments in the context of learning outcomes. What is it that we're actually trying to achieve with this assignment? And furthermore, what makes for a good, mediocre, and bad answer? And the point is, when you're trying to have either a computer or a bunch of students grade that work in a reproducible way, you have to be really precise in what the expectations are. And so that takes a fair bit of effort to develop those assessments in a way that can make them useful to the students, assessing and exercising the right things while still being gradable at scale.
I'm going to put a practical spin on that too, just so you know. We have dedicated through this fall and probably into next spring one full-time person on our technology teaching and learning staff towards this. Now, you know, we're very early in the curve, all right? And so, you know, and we have a very eclectic blend of faculty, some who are much more adept at dealing with this than others. It's not an issue of desire. It's just, you know, they've not done this. And so I'm very anxious to see how this is going to play out, because I stand by what I said. I think this is going to be a significant investment for institutions, mm-hmm. and you know, Daphne's not disagreeing. It's all about, we're making a massive change in the way you are teaching, so it's going to be struggle is not the right word, but it's going to be something we're going to have to invest in.
But I'd like to add to that, there is a huge upfront investment in these at-scale grading construction. But on the other hand, once you do that, especially if you dual-purpose the content for flipping the classroom, on-campus blended learning, then that can save you resources down the line because your TAs no longer have to grade as much as they did the first time. And in fact, they spend more time interacting with students, they spend more time on content creation, which are both much more fun than grading, I can tell you that. And so this is a much better use of resources once these assignments are constructed. So the upfront investment gets amortized actually quite nicely.
And I'm going to hold you for the last question, but I wanted to check with our moderators. Is there any online questions nobody has asked? Well, then proceed. And I think we're about at the time level where this should be the last question. So, thank you.
Daphne, I saw that students receive certificates for successful completion. Do you envision offering credit or degrees at some point? And I'm also curious what you think, like, division or at least, like, within 5 years where you see Coursera going.
Okay. So we very clearly and explicitly have no intention of offering credit ourselves or becoming a degree-granting institution. We're not an academic institution. We do not produce our own content. I do think that over the course of time, more and more institutions are going to be willing to offer credits or at least placement in the same way that people do, for example, for AP exams. So some institutions offer AP credits, some only use AP for placement, others don't accept those at all. And I think the same thing is going to happen with these courses, and some universities are going to articulate them into their programs. Others might use them for placing out of gateway classes, and others are just not going to do any of that.
Thank you. Well, I think we're out of time. In fact, we're a little over time. So if you have questions, Daphne is probably going to stay here for a few minutes.
And I can talk about the business model, even if Brian can.
So thank you.
That would be my question.